Good morning, everybody. Today, I want to look at a subject which we all are very familiar with, but we might not have actually heard too many sermons on. It's not a big subject, but it can become a big subject for many of us. And that is fear. The subject of fear. And the first thing I want us to understand is that fear has two camps. There is the positive camp of fear, and there is the negative camp of fear. And I want to look at both of those today and explain how, in the positive camp of fear, we actually learn how to please God. But in the negative camp, we actually make Him very angry and can separate Him from us. So, where to begin? Well, to start off with, we're going to look at a very simple scripture, 2 Timothy 1, verse 7. Now, I'm going to be given a number of scriptures here, and I'm also going to be relating to a few biblical stories. So you don't need to turn to them if you don't wish, but you can record them. So this is 2 Timothy 1, verse 7. For God give us a spirit not of fear, but of power and love and self-control. Now you say, but you just said fear comes into two camps. What do you mean? He's not giving us a spirit of fear. Well, to understand that a wee bit better, we need to understand about these two camps. The first camp, the positive camp, is about the fear of God. Now, this causes a lot of problems because, as I said there in Timothy, God hasn't given us a spirit to be afraid of. He's given us a spirit of power, of authority, of knowing and having a relationship with a loving father in a family and a family relationship. So you see, that's already there. But we find in the Old Testament that there are a number of differing verses telling us that really, you know, when you approach God, you should do so trembling. Now, when we think of that trembling concept, we get the idea you're supposed to do it with such awe and respect and worry. You know, in case you don't match up to what's required. And that's exactly how it was viewed in the Old Testament. Because that was the problem. There was the possibility that you, the individual, who by your own strength were living according to the rules of the law and the regulations that lay down in the land, might not actually be matching up to what was being expected. So there was always that fear. So when we approached the Old Testament concept of law, that fear is very much there. Are we good enough? But however, in the New Testament, that fear is gone. And that's why we have to understand this thing what Timothy's on about. Because he's saying, this spirit that has been given to you now, this new spirit has changed your relationship with God. He no longer is looking at what you do. He's no longer expecting you to achieve results in the sense of righteousness. He's going to sort that out for you. He's made a sacrifice which will cover all your sins through His Son Jesus Christ. And He has placed you into a permanent relationship of grace with Him. Now that word grace, that's a great word. Apart from being a girl's name, we have to understand that it actually means favour. That's all it means. So you've been put into a situation where you're being looked at favourably by God. Now, those of us who have been employed from time to time know the advantage. If you find favour with an employer, it can make life a lot easier. Whereas if you are working for someone who, shall we say, doesn't quite like you, your life is going to be terrible. And that's the difference that we see between the grace. So in the Old Testament, when they didn't have grace, they had works, and they had to show obedience. They were always worried. How would this carry through? What would they need to do? Was their sacrifice good enough? Was that other lamb, at the back of the pasture, pasture, which they couldn't have decided between because they were so alike and they wanted to give him the best. But what if he thought the other one was better than the one I've just sacrificed? This was the problem, you see. This was part of the fear of God. Part of it. But that fear for Christians is different. We don't have that. But we do, as Christians, have another fear. This other fear is a bigger problem. And I mean, it's a real problem. Let me explain a little about it. But to do it, we're going to use a story. Let's go to 1 Samuel. For those of you who are aware of this sort of story, you'll not need to go to it in reality because you'll understand it. We're being introduced to a young shepherd boy called David. At a time when there was a war in Israel between Israel and the Philistines. Now, it so happened that the two armies, the Philistines and Israel, or Israel and the Philistines, depending on which way you want to put it, were equally matched. Now, basically, in the Orient, Middle East areas, you would find that when you had a situation where two armies were equally matched, there was a running thought, if we literally go head to head here, the casualties are going to be extreme. We're going to wipe out near enough each other's entire peoples. And then some smart aleck from another country is going to come and take over both our lands. So it's a bit silly, actually, to kill ourselves here. So what if we could come to an amicable arrangement? And so what one of the arrangements was is, let's pick two champions. Let them fight for the honour and privilege of representing the entire armies. Now, this was a common custom among all the nations. But you must understand this, it wasn't considered the strength of the individual. It was always considered to be that God was fighting, true champion. Now, for the Philistines, they had their God, and they had their champion. Now, this wasn't exactly someone who we would meet every day in the street. Goliath was estimated to be between 9 and 10 foot tall. Now, I don't want you to think of some big, tall, lanky guy. That's not Goliath. His armor was so heavy, two ordinary strong men couldn't lift it. So you understand, this guy went to war in armor that two men couldn't lift. And he worked perfectly well with it on him. So he was big. He was scary. He had a loud voice. When he bellowed, his voice cried all the way over the valleys to where the Israelites were standing. And they heard his taunt. Is your God no good? Can he not bring me a champion from Israel? The answer, of course, was, as far as the Israelites were concerned, no way was any of them going to go down and deal with this guy. I mean, think about it. What do you do? Kick him in the shins? You should see the armor there. You crack your toe. Never mind anything else. And one swipe from him and... Flies have better chance of survival than you would have at that moment in time. And that was how they looked at it. So no way. There's a standoff. Israel was refusing to give a champion. Now Israel's king at that time was a tall man by Israelite standards called Saul. Now Saul in and by himself, as I said, was tall, but he wasn't it's the Goliath. And though anyway, it wasn't acceptable for kings to go into battle. You sent a champion. And he had many champions. He had many men of valor who were great, and some of them were this young shepherd boy's brothers. But even they wouldn't go against Goliath. This was a stalemate. It looked as if the armies themselves might have to go head to head. And even the armies didn't want to go against Goliath by themselves. I mean, this guy scared them. Now, armies always eat on their, they always march on their stomachs. Isn't that what they say? Armies march on their stomachs, and so when the food runs out, you have a problem. And when Israel has been camped there for weeks, and the weeks are turning into months, and this is going on, this stalemate, it became necessary for the families of the truce to send food to the front line, so to speak. David, however, wasn't in the army. He looked after the sheep. But all his brothers were. So his father decided, I'm going to send you with enough food for all the people, for all your people in the army, so that you can actually have feed them and all, and you can tell me what's happening, how the battle's faring, and you know what's going on. So David's excited, great, get away from the sheep, get on up there, see the battlefront. Very excited. He's a young lad in that sense. He's maybe about 17, 18 years old. He wouldn't have been much older than that. Some even suggest he might have been younger. But the whole point of the thing was, he himself was excited about all this. He got up, gave his brothers the food, walked around the lines, looked over at the camp, saw the Philistine army stretching all over the horizon, saw the Israelite army stretching all over their end over here, and said, okay, when's the battle start? Because he wanted to see it. No, they stay over there, we stay here, that's just how it goes at the moment, said his brothers. It was at this point that Goliath appeared. Now, you've got to understand Goliath. He'd been doing this now for days, weeks, maybe even months. He was getting a bit peeved. So every time he came, he was thinking of new taunts to annoy the Israelites with. And this one that he came up with today was a doozy. He started picking on God. Your God obviously must be no good. He can't pick a champion among the whole of Israel that would fight me. And so he's going on like this. David, however, didn't like the tone of his voice. And says, well, I'm not having that. I'm sorting that barbarian out. And he says, I'll fight him. And the brother said, David, listen, I know we look small. We're a wee bit away from him. But you see that tree? Well, that tree that's beside him there, that's a good 20-foot tree. Do you notice that he's nearly half the height of it? I mean, come on. Realize, this guy here is big. He said, that's nothing to do. You don't worry about the size. See, when I was out looking after my sheep, I would have different things that would come against me. There was the lion. Now the lions, as you know, don't like not getting their lamb when they want to, when they're hungry. They are determined. But I would get the sling, I'd swing it around, wait for it, see him, get him between the eyes, and flip. And that lion would go, whoa, what happened? And then the second stone, I'd make sure that he knew I had him hard then, because then I'd get him on the point where he's turning, he's looking at me, because that's what I want him to do. I want him to see me. And I fire the stone and it hit him straight in the face. Again. And do you know what he'd do then? He'd start wandering like that there, backwards. And then he would turn. And as soon as he turned, I would get the next two stones right at his butt. And he'd be running up the thing. And the last stone would just whiz by the side of his ear. And in five stones, I can clear any line from the camp. No bother. No difficulty whatsoever. So David was busy, you know, giving it all he's got, explaining that this really was no problem. And they would go, that's a lion. That is a warrior of the Philistine army, and he's massive. He's trained killer. A lion only wants the sheep. But it was no good. David had seen it his way, couldn't move him. In the end, he was taken to Saul. Saul, the king. Now, what Saul didn't know was that at this time, David already had been anointed to become next king of Israel. He didn't know that the Spirit of God had already been poured on this boy to make him a powerful warrior, the champion of God. Saul didn't know that. He just saw a shepherd boy. But this shepherd boy impressed him. This shepherd boy convinced a king to put all his trust on him, to go and fight a giant that no one else would even look towards. Now think about this, because this, if David loses this battle, Israel has given up the fight. She's basically throwing in her tabs. She surrenders. That's it over. This is what this meant. Yet here it was. The king is willing to accept David as the champion. So he says, let's get you kitted out, put armor on you. I know you're going to fight this battle, so we'll give you the king's own armor, the best armor in the place, fashioned, strong, glorious. They struck it on David. Do you know what happened? He couldn't walk. It's just too heavy, too big. He said, I don't believe that. David heads off to fight a giant. He goes down into the valley. And Goliath is waiting. And he sees it. There in the distance, there's a speck. Somebody's actually coming out. Ah! They're sending somebody. Wonder if it's a big guy. He doesn't look all that big. He gets closer. Where's his sword? He gets closer. He's got no shield. He gets closer. He's a boy. What are they sending a boy out against me for? Are they taking the proverbial? Here was the situation. Goliath didn't know whether he should laugh or be angry. But the humor of the situation was such that he couldn't help but laugh. The idea that Israel felt that their God was so powerful that he could defeat the might of the Philistine army in the shape of Goliath with a boy, with a sling, was so ridiculous. I mean, come on. What do they think their God is? Almighty or something? I mean, it was one of those things. But guess what? Sling started to move. And the laughter stopped with a stone. One stone. Not five. Five had been taken because David preferred to have five stones because he understood the tactic that he was going to use. Same tactic he had used against the lion and all the other animals he had to scare off from the sheep. He had taken the five stones for that reason. But yet the one stone hit the giant right in the temple. Giant's laughter just stopped. You could have seen the surprised look on his face from the Israelite camp, and that was some distance away. He just dropped to his knees. All the Philistines said, what? Is he getting down on his knees here because of the laughter or what? They couldn't understand. They couldn't see what had happened. They couldn't figure this out. Next thing, the large giant just collapsed straight down on his face. The young shepherd boy walks over. Everybody's still standing watching, totally quiet. You could have heard a pin drop. He pulls out the giant's sword. It's massive. He's hardly able to lift it. He pulls it up as high as he can and he drops it. The weight of the sword is all it takes to cut the giant head completely off his body. And the head. That massive head that almost filled David's viewpoint when he held it up was held up to Israel and to the Philistines. The Philistine army up stakes and ran. They headed out of that valley that they were in as quick as they could because the whole Israelite army was now in full pursuit of them. God deals with fear differently than we would. You see, this is what was happening in that story. Fear had personalized into one individual, a giant called Goliath. Fear was what the Israelites saw. And they had no trust in God and no ability to understand that it wasn't by their strength or their ability that they were going to deal with the problem. It would have to be done by God. And so they stood waiting, listening as God was taunted and taunted and taunted. But when the time was right, God sent a champion. And Goliath couldn't believe it. Fear thought, this is ridiculous, look what they're bringing against me. Fear is like that. We say, we have to understand, fear that paralyzes you, that won't allow you to do things, that completely stops you in your track. Fear that you see as a massive mountain that's getting in your way. When it's dealt with by God, it's reduced to nothing. When God steps in to intervene, it comes nothing. Let me tell you another story about fear. This is a combination of two fears. I mean, obviously we know that David feared God, and that was one of the reasons why he didn't fear the giant. But before David, when Israel had been taken out of Egypt, they were brought to the very borders of the promised land. And God said, I'm going to send spies into the land so that they can bring back a report to the people of how good this land is that I'm giving them. So they can see the bounty of it. So 12 individuals, one from each house of Israel, was sent out into the land. And they were there 40 days. We all know the story. But what we might not realize, and I want to just turn here, it's in Numbers 13 and 14, if you just want to keep an aspect of that, is that when they came back, they give a poor or negative report, or at least 10 of them did. But I want us to look at this for a moment. I want us to think about what they actually said. What they were saying was, yes, all 12 of them, said the same thing. The land is bountiful. We have got grapes here of one bough that we're having to carry between two men. There is milk, there is honey, there is plenty of food, crops. It is wonderful. It is the most beautiful land you've ever seen. But that's where the two stories differ. Because now they're asked about who's in the land. Now all 12 acknowledge the fact that there are remnants of the Achaeans there. Amalekites, the Vimians, all of these ancient giant races. But two of the spies says, but they're not going to be a problem because when we've got God with us, nothing can stand against us. But the other 10 says, look, all of their cities, all of their towns are well fortified. All of their marching and fighting men are armed to the teeth and skilled, well trained for battle. And these giants, we're like grasshoppers beside them. Now, that was enough. Just that report, because it broke the heart of Israel and they refused to accept anything about going into this land. But that was enough for God. He decided to directly intervene. And what he says to them, and depending on what version of the Bible you're reading, you'll find it in chapter 34 of Numbers 14. Verse 34 of Numbers 14. According to the number of the days in which you spied out the land, which is 40 days, for each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year, that is 40 years, and you shall know my rejection. Now, in other translations of the Bible, that you shall know my rejection is translated, and you shall know what it's like for me to be your enemy. And that's exactly what Israel did have for that 40 years in the wilderness. They learned what it was like for God to fight them. Because he refused to let them into the land, and he broke them. It was also at this time that he brought extra laws, regulations, and commands in upon them. Because they needed to understand. Now, why did he do that? Well, funny enough, the Bible tells us a very important thing as far as God's concerned. It's to do with childbearing. We all know this. It's not exactly very acceptable or PC statements these days, but we all know it. And the statement is this. Folly is bound up in the heart of the child, but the rod of discipline will drive it from him. That's Proverbs 22, verse 15. And again in Proverbs 3:11, verse 12, "My son, do not spur the Lord's correction, nor see offence at his reproof. For those who he loves, the Lord reproves, and he punishes his favourite son." Why? Because it's necessary. A couple of hundred years ago, if you were talking to a parent and you said to them, "How do you discipline your child?" they would very graphically tell you how they went about it. They would either use the birch, the slipper, the belt, and in some cases, extreme cases, horsewhipped. Now, needless to say, when we hear those things, we go, "That's terrible. That's horrible." But you see, the difference was they weren't punishing their children for fun. They were punishing their children because they believed that if a child learned respect and fear of authority as a child, then it would stay with them the rest of their life and they'd live a happy, peaceful life and understand there's rules and regulations you apply to. Very simple rule. Very simple principle. How long has it been in effect? Time immemorial is a good way of putting it, because it goes right back through every society and agent of every country, nation and people that exist in the world. Without exception. Until now. Today, we have a different problem. Today, the law states, that's the law of the land, not the law of God, the law states that you are not permitted to discipline your child using physical means. And what that basically means is that while it's accepted that you might clip them around the ear, it will be frowned upon, especially if you damage their ear and their hearing, if you were to use a rod, stick, staff, slipper, or any other instrument, it is assault, and you will do time in prison for assaulting another human being. So you begin to see the principle here. So the only thing left for you to do is reason with them. Thus we have the naughty step and little things like that there that have been done. The principle is that you treat children as adults and respect them as you would like to be respected yourself. Because ultimately this has to be a Christian idea, hasn't it? But it's not. This is a perversion of Christianity. And that's the difficulty that we have to understand. So what's the result that ends up with this? Believe it or not, fear. Fear exists when children are not disciplined. First of all, you've got fear from the child itself. You see, the son who is the favourite is disciplined by the father because of the love of the father, and he knows that the father loves him. So he knows that whatever discipline is brought in is measured for that reason, to bring the best out of him, because ultimately he's going to inherit everything. But the son that is not disciplined automatically assumes that he's not the favourite. He's not cared about. Nobody worries what he does. And that's the situation that's happening with many of our youth today. They, because there is no level of discipline in the home, no respect, they literally got to a stage where they believe that they are uncared for, unwanted, and it doesn't matter what they do. They are rejecting their parents because they feel their parents are rejecting them. And you know, there's strong evidence to support that they are. Because parents who do not discipline their children do not have the same relationship with them as parents who do. Now, discipline comes in many ways, and as I say, because of legal reasons, frequently, it's not a what they call corporal punishment anymore. It's more to do with consequences than anything else. But we find, when we explore what's happening around us in our society especially, that parents really can't be bothered enforcing consequences And that's the problem. You see, a consequence is no pocket money for a week, but the child, yap, 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 yap. And before long, take that and go out of here. What happened to the consequence? Didn't exist. Before that, come here. What happened to the consequence? Well, it just happened. It was instant. The child knows all about it. You don't have to worry about it anymore. You don't have to hold it in mind. The child said, it happened immediately. I got what I deserved. I know if I don't want that to happen again, I just don't do that. And the parent knows that they have reacted accordingly to what they understand to be right. We might disapprove from a legal or social standing, but at the end of the day, we're told even in Scripture that to delay punishment is a tragedy. It's wrong, because you forget why you were going to punish the person. So we have these differences, different problems. But what's that going to do with fear? Well, you see, if children don't have a relationship with their parents, if they believe that parents don't care for them, then they believe that the world doesn't care about them either. And because they're children, that's exactly how they feel about the world. They begin to rebel. They begin to put their needs first. They begin to become aggressive tyrants to everyone they meet. And they do that simply because they haven't had the respect and love shown to them by a parent who's willing to stop them in their tracks and saying, stop. You cannot do that. And it's as simple as that. Stop. You cannot do that. And enforce it. God isn't tied up with our laws. He's not worried about it. Every single one of you sitting in this room are his children. If you step out of place, that is, decide to go and follow your own due and worship other gods and behave inappropriately as he would imagine, do not think for one second he will not come down on you like a ton of bricks. He will. His hand is not short. When he hits you, you will know it. And he has made us a promise. He will punish every child of his that steps out of line. Because we reflect him in everything we do. Everything reflects him. So he will punish you. So how should you feel about God? Well, for a start, you might think you should fear him. And you do. The same as a child who has a healthy relationship with their parent doesn't do wrong because they're afraid of the consequence. They say, no, my dad would kill me if I did that. My mom could throw me for a shortcut. Hey. No, I grew up understanding that because that's exactly how all my peers would have talked. They would have said, no, no, I'm not doing that. You would see what my parents would give me if I'm stuck with it. I'm just not doing it. Because it's a deterrent works. They knew exactly what to expect. But we as Christians need to know exactly what to expect if we don't do what's proper. Listen, in closing, I want to bring us one thought. Very simple thought. There's two types of fear. The negative and the positive. We mentioned that at the very beginning. The positive fear is very good. It brings you a level of protection from doing wrong, because it teaches you that your God will discipline you without hesitation. But the negative is useless. The negative fear is when you're afraid of things that have no power over you whatsoever, and that is this world. The schoolyard bully can be a great threat to many a young child at school. The schoolyard bully works on the Goliath principle. They're bigger and louder than everybody else. And for most times, while they might hit you a thump, most of your fear that you have of them is the intimidation more than anything else. And that's what you're afraid of. There is a schoolyard bully who we all need to be aware of. He's called Satan. And I want you to understand this. While you start as Christians, as children, there is an expectation on you to grow to maturity, full adulthood. And I don't know about anyone here, but maybe you could relate your own stories later. If any of you actually had a schoolyard bully, when you screw up, were you still afraid of them? The answer, in most of the cases, would be no. I realised that they were absolutely on a downward road and there was no use. As you grow and mature as Christians, you have to understand that that schoolyard bully called Satan also has no power. He can irritate you, he can annoy you, he can trip you up, he can cause you problems, he can call you names. He can force you into every situation of fear that he can get, but he cannot at any time make you do anything. You have all the power and authority given to you over him. In reality, you can become David and he's your Goliath. And the Holy Spirit has already supplied you with a sling and 5 stones. So don't worry about it. No matter how often he comes back, this giant has no teeth. Thank you.